Lincoln Heights has been in national headlines after a neo-Nazi rally on an overpass between the historically black neighborhood and Evendale. The incident has left lingering questions. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about the tension between constitutional rights and protecting people from hate, our University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor Ryan Thorson. Thanks for being here, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And WVXU reporter Nick Swartzell. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, Lucy.
Nick, what do we know about what happened on that overpass?
Yeah, so Friday afternoon, a group of about 12 people dressed in black, some of them bearing swastika flags, others with assault rifles, kind of took their places along the bridge and displayed those flags and a banner with a white supremacist slogan. Residents of Lincoln Heights began kind of moving toward that group to confront them. At the same time, Evendale police were responding and Hamilton County sheriffs, which kind of fill the law enforcement role in Lincoln Heights, were responding as well. Evendale police took the Evendale side and tried to engage the neo-Nazis, and Hamilton County sheriffs kind of engaged with the folks that were counter-protesting. There were some tense moments between counter-protesters and the neo-Nazis. Eventually, according to police, the neo-Nazis decided to leave. At some point, according to a lot of social media video we've seen, some of the counter-protesters seized one of the Nazi flags and eventually burned it. Mm. And that's kind of how things unfolded. The neo-Nazis took off in a U-Haul. And we know various things about kind of where that U-Haul went and what happened afterward.
Yeah. What have Evendale police said, Nick, about how they responded? I know there's been some criticism, some questioning.
Sure. Evendale police issued a statement saying they, obviously condemn the neo-Nazis and their message, that they were mostly concerned with defusing the situation so there was no violence. And also, though, that there were no real laws broken that they could enforce. They did kind of mention that I've seen in some news coverage that they admitted there might have been a few small, kind of laws broken, one of them being you're not supposed to ride in the back of a U-Haul, for instance. But they said their main focus was on defusing the situation instead of issuing like minor citations.
Okay. Ryan, the U.S. Supreme Court has generally ruled in favor of very broad protections for speech in America. Can you walk us through a sort of summary of First Amendment protections for speech? What is and isn't covered?
Yeah, definitely. So generally, the Supreme Court has said that there is broad protection even for speech that is considered hateful or offensive by the general public or by particular groups. And that's to protect a robust freedom of expression in the United States. But even that has limits. And a couple of those limits have been articulated by the Supreme Court in various cases stretching over the last 70 years. One limit is what's known as fighting words. If a person who is engaged in offensive speech makes a kind of direct attack on a person that they're speaking with, and it's the kind of attack that might provoke that person to violence, that can be stopped under like a disorderly conduct law or under a local ordinance. Another kind of speech that is not protected are true threats. So if a speaker intends to communicate a real threat of violence to another person, that also is not protected by the First Amendment. And then incitement to violence is another category that is not protected. And that's a fairly high bar to show that something is incitement to violence. Famously, the doctrine for incitement to violence comes out of Brandenburg versus Ohio, a case decided out of Cincinnati resulting from a Ku Klux Klan rally in the late 1960s. But to show incitement to violence, you have to show that the person actually intended to incite violence or imminent lawless action, and that that violence or imminent lawless action was actually likely to result. And sometimes that can be hard to show, especially in the heat of a protest moment when people are expressing very hateful but also very sincerely held beliefs.
Ryan, in some of the social media videos we've seen that seem to be authentic, you can see these neo-Nazi protesters directing pretty offensive racial epithets at some of the counter-protesters. Does that ever rise to the level of these fighting words or incitement? Can those racial epithets actually be cross the line.
It certainly can. And that has been addressed in some of the fighting words jurisprudence, particularly the use of kind of the most offensive racial epithets aimed at a particular person. At the point where that stops being a kind of general statement or expression of belief and starts being directed at a specific person, that can tip across the line from protected expression to fighting words.
I see. Law enforcement officials said they didn't really have prior knowledge of the neo-Nazi rally. Some critics have pointed out that means there was no permit issued approving the rally. What role do permits and that kind of thing play in regulating speech? Can a municipality require those permits under the First Amendment? And what happens if they turn down a permit application?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there is good Supreme Court jurisprudence on this as well, saying that generally permits aren't needed to stage some kind of demonstration in the public sphere. So places like streets or sidewalks are open to the public to express their views so long as they're not obstructing vehicular or pedestrian traffic or otherwise interfering with the purposes of those streets or sidewalks. There are areas like, you know, public plazas or public parks where cities can require protesters or demonstrators to get a permit in advance, recognizing that there are many groups that might want to use that space, and some groups using it might prevent others from enjoying it as well. Generally, the rule with those permits is that they have to be neutral as to the content of the speech, so they can't discriminate against particular viewpoints or viewpoints that the city disagrees with. They have to be administered in a fair and neutral manner.
Ryan, I remember when I moved back to the region in the late 1990s, the KKK had a cross on Fountain Square, typically over the Christmas holidays. It happened several years in a row. I think a lot of people wondered, how could something like that happen? Why is something like that, or was it allowed?
Yeah, generally, because states can't discriminate on the basis of viewpoint, can't restrict a particular group from expressing views that it finds particularly odious, as long as groups kind of comply with the neutral requirements, even if their views are offensive, or even if they're a group that is opposed by the general public, they have the right to access those spaces on the same grounds. And there are restrictions on that as well, right? If speech is obscene, if it falls into kind of exceptions from the First Amendment, then you might not be able to erect something like a cross. But if it's just a disfavored group, they'd have the same right as anyone else.
We're talking about the tension between constitutional rights and protecting people from hate. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wbxu.org. Ryan, some countries, I'm thinking of Germany here, have restrictions on displaying symbols like a swastika. What's the reasoning there, and why doesn't the U.S. generally have those kinds of restrictions?
A lot of countries in the world recognize that hate speech does do real harm to the social fabric and to individuals. There's a constitutional law scholar, Jeremy Waldron, who writes about kind of the two harms that hate speech does. One is that it makes our society more divided. It kind of rends at the social fabric. But it also has very real consequences for the communities that are targeted, right? Knowing that they are disfavored by other members of the community, fearing that they might be harmed or discriminated against. And for that reason, a lot of countries have enacted hate speech regulations that restrict the expression of hateful or offensive speech. The U.S.'s First Amendment has generally led those kinds of laws to be held unconstitutional in the United States, even though many cities and states have certainly tried to pass legislation like that. But generally, under international law, it's not just permissible, it's required. There are human rights agreements, including ones that the United States has ratified, that say that states should take action to prohibit hate speech for the good of anti-discrimination and equality in the society. But because of the First Amendment, the U.S. has a very high bar for enacting any kind of regulation on speech.
Ryan, it sounds like maybe the standard for the First Amendment is, unless the speech is going to like imminently incite some kind of violence or harm, then it's generally permitted, whereas other countries take a more long-term view about like how corrosive that speech might be over time. Is that accurate to say?
I think that's a fair characterization, yes. And I think a lot of the countries that have taken action against particular forms of speech, like you know, denying the Holocaust or glorifying the Nazi Party in Germany, have a very deep and immediate historical experience with the way that hate speech tips over into violence, right? Understanding that hate speech lays the groundwork for actual violence to be committed against people.
We've been talking about the First Amendment. Let's switch gears just a bit and talk about the Second Amendment. Several of the neo-Nazis who showed up on this overpass had assault rifles, and citing Second Amendment protections, Ohio lawmakers have passed, you know, pretty permissive open carry laws. Are there instances when having a weapon could constitute being menacing during a protest?
It's an interesting tension, and I think it was interesting to see in some of the police statements that they mention, you know, needing to keep the group separate because one side at least was heavily armed, and kind of nodding to the fact that they were armed as a reason to keep them separate. There is a right to carry weapons in many parts of the United States, but you can still factor the carrying of a weapon into something like a true threat analysis, right? In determining whether somebody is making a threat toward another person that is a real threat and that they could potentially carry out, it might matter that they are carrying a weapon or that they're brandishing the weapon at the other person or otherwise kind of intimating that this isn't just an abstract notion of violence that they're advocating, but a very real threat of violence that's being communicated to a particular person.
Ryan, at some of the counter protests I saw recently for this, anti-Nazi demonstrators also had guns, and they didn't really seem to get a lot of extra attention from law enforcement the times that I saw. But I heard a lot of talk about like, oh, you know, we get treated differently when we bring our guns to our protests. Is there a like sort of historical precedent for that? Has the Second Amendment always been applied equally to folks who carry their weapons?
No, certainly not. And I think this has been highlighted in some of the recent instances of police violence against people of color, where, you know, they'll use the fact that they thought that the person had a gun as a justification for using fatal violence against them, even in states where it is permissible for a person to carry a gun, where that is a robustly protected under the Second Amendment and open carry laws are in place. So I think that criticism is not wrong, and I think people are correct to expect that the police will be consistent in the way that they police protests and that they protect the First Amendment and that kind of expressive activity in a protest setting.
I see.
Nick, you mentioned earlier this idea that people have criticized, well, hey, the neo-Nazis got away in a U-Haul. Do officers, law enforcement officers, have to use discretion to kind of cite people for offenses like that? I mean, it is illegal to haul a bunch of people around in the back of a U-Haul, but these neo-Nazis didn't seem to get cited for that. What's that tension for law enforcement?
Yeah, I think that is a real tension, in part because, you know, police enforce laws somewhat selectively all of the time, right? Deciding that something is not worth their time, something like jaywalking, for instance, where they might witness that and not ticket the person just because it's such a minor offense. Here, I think the tension is very much heightened because of the circumstances in which riding in the back of a U-Haul took place and where police might exercise a great deal of discretion. I think this is an instance where the community's eyes are on them and there might be a different expectation that they kind of robustly enforce the laws that the city of Cincinnati and the state of Ohio have put in place.
Ryan, I know we talked about Brandenburg versus Ohio. Are there other Supreme Court cases that are kind of like elemental to understanding how we got to our sort of like First Amendment protection of hate speech?
Yeah. Each of the categorical exceptions to the First Amendment that I mentioned before has some seminal case law around it that sets out the standards for when speech is not protected and when people might expect that police have an obligation to intervene for acts of racist speech. Around fighting words, there's a case called Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire, which involved a man who kind of complained against city government, including with some kind of personal invective towards state officials. That person was arrested for a breach of the peace, and that was upheld under the fighting words doctrine. For true threats, there's a case called Virginia versus Black, where the Supreme Court found that burning a cross could constitute a true threat, could actually communicate a very real threat of violence that could be prohibited or punished under the First Amendment. And then finally, Brandenburg is kind of the classic example from Ohio, where the court did set a pretty high bar for incitement to violence out of a Ku Klux Klan rally here in Cincinnati.
I see. This is a little tangential to the conversation, but I think it is important. Can you talk to us about the First Amendment and flag burning? Because there was a flag burned at the site of this protest here.
Yeah. It's a really interesting area of First Amendment law. You know, many states had tried to ban flag burning, suggesting that it was patriotic and it was kind of a violation of patriotic commitments in the United States. And those laws have been held unconstitutional because they were directly aimed at the kinds of viewpoints that people wanted to express, right? Respect for the flag and respect for the United States was protected as a speech under the First Amendment, but disrespect for the flag or opposition to the United States was prohibited by the government. And they said, you know, you can't do that. You can't put your thumb on the scale and favor one viewpoint over another in the United States as the government. That may be different in circumstances like the one that unfolded at the protest on the 7th, because that was somebody else's flag that was taken and burned. With the American flag cases, it tended to be laws that specifically prohibited the burning of the American flag, and it was the person's own flag that they burned, and that was protected speech. Taking a flag from a government official or for another private individual and setting it on fire could still be, you know, a violation of like theft laws or arson laws or something like that, consistent with the First Amendment.
I see. Yeah.
Ryan, are there generally, is there advice you would offer in terms of what the proper response should be to events like neo-Nazi rallies? I mean, how tough is it for officials to kind of walk this fine line that's required? And what would your advice be to people who want to confront hate groups when they see them out rallying?
I think one important thing is that often these groups have much more advanced notice that they will be protesting than police or counter-protesters do, right? They have time to strategize, to coordinate with each other, to kind of make their message maximally offensive, and think about what they'll do if the police respond in particular ways, where both the police and the counter-protesters are often caught off guard and don't know what to expect. Some groups, I'll say, use this to their advantage, right? That they kind of goad people into attacking them or goad police into repressing their speech and then turn around and file lawsuits against the city or the police department. I think one thing that's very important for counter-protesters is to know the limits of the First Amendment, to know that fighting words and true threats and incitement to violence are not protected and that police can be expected to intervene in those instances. And then to do what many of the counter-protesters last week did, to document the kind of verbal violence that's being committed, to document instances that might run afoul of the First Amendment, so that when the smoke clears and when things are settled, they can talk to police about the way that they're policing these protests and what they could have done differently or more effectively to ensure that speech that is not protected by the First Amendment isn't used to threaten local communities.
So I'm going to ask you a question that might have a long answer, and we only have a few more minutes, but I want to ask it anyway. So Brandenburg was decided in 1969. A lot of these cases are somewhat old. What do we need to be thinking about in the internet age as it comes to these things?
Yeah, I think one challenge with the internet age is that a lot of these precedents assume that we are talking about face-to-face speech, right? Somebody speaking on a street corner in a park to an audience that might be like-minded or might oppose their views. And so a lot of them kind of privilege exceptions for face-to-face communication, right? Fighting words has to be a personal epithet kind of directed at another person in the moment. It can't be a crude tweet or something like that. True threats certainly can be communicated over the internet. Incitement to violence generally has to be imminent lawless action. And so something that's, you know, a racist or fascist website might not amount to incitement to imminent lawless action. So I do think that social media poses a real challenge in the way that we think about these things, and underscores the role of private actors, you know, like social media platforms, in thinking very carefully about what they allow to be disseminated on their platforms as private entities, and also the way that we as private individuals respond to speech that we find odious or offensive. I think it's no accident that the neo-Nazis who marched on the 7th were wearing masks, right? They know that these views are offensive. They know that the majority of the community doesn't hold them. And they know that there could be professional or personal repercussions if their identities and their association with these views were known.
Well, this has been fascinating. Nick, I'm going to let you close it out with a quick question. What are you going to be watching for with this? I know you've been following this whole thing for us here at WVXU.
Well, I think obviously looking for signs that there might be another neo-Nazi event in Cincinnati or nearby, especially at protests that are happening, you know, around Trump's administration policies or things like that. But also, I think how Lincoln Heights is responding and how they're trying to heal from this, because I think there is still a lot of anxiety there now.
Yeah. Well, we will continue to follow your work. I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Assistant Professor Ryan Thorson and WBXU reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you missed our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.